Good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Berendt, and I welcome you to this seminar, which is sponsored by the Friendship Connection. And the purpose, our objectives today, are to help you understand the dynamics, the issues that go into helping people who have learning disabilities cope with their social problems, their emotional issues, independent skills, and the future. I'd like to tell you how I got into this. In 1975, when I was out of graduate school, I was working in a community center as a youth worker, and I had never heard the term learning disability. And one day, a mother comes into my office with her daughter, a teenager, and this mother was very distraught, and you could look at the teenager, and you could see that she was quite awkward, and there were some obvious problems there. And she explained to me, "My daughter has learning disabilities. Where can I go to get help for socialization?" It's a good question. I didn't have the answer. But being a concerned professional, I started to do some research at that point. And I found some interesting things. I found there was a group for some retarded individuals. I found a little program for individuals who were physically challenged. But I found absolutely nothing for people who had learning disabilities, who were high-functioning, developmentally delayed, or for that matter, nothing for the mainstream population where people had social problems. So at that point, I happened to be lucky enough to be working with a young woman who was doing special education for the Girl Scouts. Remember, this was 1975. And we started a program in this community center for adolescents with learning disabilities, a social group, which was the first of its kind, which was the seed of what today is one of the few programs in the country that specializes in working with people who have social disabilities, social handicaps, social anxiety, a major component of whom also have learning disabilities. And as we begin, I'd like to just do one little exercise, if I may. Anybody know what the number one phobia in the country is? Yes, very good. I would like to pick on someone for a moment. Can I give somebody some anxiety? Come on now. I'm going to pick on you. You don't even have to stand up. I'd like you to tell me how you got here today. You didn't expect that, did you?
No.
Okay, easy question. How did you get here?
We drove.
Okay, but wait a minute. Right, and the easy answers are not necessarily productive. But anyway, you started from where?
Dobbs Ferry.
And you turned down a specific street, I imagine. Mm-hmm. And then you got onto what expressway?
Ultimately, the LII.
LIE, okay.
No, I don't live in Long Island.
Okay, that's okay. You're doing very well. Then you got to Northern Boulevard,
right,
and then to New York Institute of Technology, and you turned into this particular building, et cetera. Okay, what's the moral of the story? This man has a map, keyword, a map, in his brain that he takes for granted. The map is comprised and composed of specific information. The purpose of this workshop or seminar today is to give you all information that you need if you are going to make any changes for your children and yourselves. It is the information which is the power. The more information you have, the more power you have to be productive with the people that you are concerned about. If you do not have this information, there's a good bet that unwittingly you will be susceptible to what I call enabling behavior, which is something that we will address as the seminar goes on. A few years ago, as my program was developing, this was after I was in the community center and had started my private practice, I was fortunate enough to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show, among other shows. And a very interesting thing happened. The title of this show, this was back in 1989, was Social Phobia. One of the women who I brought on, one of my patients, was a young woman named Susan. And one of the things that attracted the producers, remember, if you're going on a show like this, the producers are looking for ratings, they're looking for meaty stories, and these days the shows are so crazy that I can't even get on anymore. But anyway, the premise of this particular person was she had her first date at age 39. Now, Susan was a relatively attractive young woman, well put together, well groomed, had a nice civil service job, making about $30,000 a year. Very nice appearance. Susan also had learning disabilities. And as the Oprah Winfrey Show was going on and we got to Susan, it was interesting because Oprah was getting all kinds of phone calls from the listening audience saying, "You're browbeating her." She was asking a lot of questions because she did not understand how a woman at age 39 could have her first date at that age. And she was asking questions, I remember it very vividly. Were your parents so much fun that you wanted to hang out with them? She was genuinely confused because she had not seen anything like this before. And her answer, her response to the audience was, "I'm not browbeating Susan, I just really do not understand." And when we're talking about learning disabilities, we're talking about a lot of confusion when it comes to diagnostic cataloging, a lot of confusion when it comes to specific diagnostics in itself. At one point, I was going to write a book. The original title of my book was going to be Between the Cracks. Because I have heard so many parents come to me and say, "Well, my child has this problem and that problem, but no one really understands it. He or she falls between the cracks." That ended up not to be the title of my book. The title of my book is Beyond Shine, is How to Conquer Social Anxieties. But this is a very important thing, between the cracks. Now, I can imagine that a lot of you are thinking, you know, my child or the person I'm concerned about fits this category. There's no specific diagnostics, but I can assure you that 10,000 patients later, I started my private practice in 1978, what appears to some people to be between the cracks, for others, from a professional perspective, there are very, very definitive patterns. And what I'd like to do now is to show you some of the patterns that exist. When Susan was talking on the Oprah Winfrey Show, yes, sure, she had a learning disability, she had a social problem, she had social skills deficits, but let me take you through what a basic pattern is. And I wish this were bigger, but if you can just focus. First, we're starting with the concept of a learning disability. That's what brings you here today. A learning disability can be very specific, or it can be what's called pervasive. I had an interesting thing happen to me on Thursday. I went out to my house in East Hampton. After I see my patients, I go out to East Hampton where I live, and that's where I do my creative work. And one of the first things that I do when I get there is I turn on my computer to get my email. It's very exciting. People from around the world looking for information, wanting to buy books, doing research. And I couldn't get my email. I could not get in because I was trying to get in through AT&T, and it was saying you can't get in, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I'm not technologically minded. I called my computer person. He couldn't help me. I couldn't get my email that day. I'm freaking out. I'm angry because I have business there. So the next day, I focused by myself, and I found the technical support number, and I called up, and I had to spend 1 hour, 1 hour on the telephone remedying this. And finally, the guy said, "What you have here is an account problem, not a technical problem. What's your telephone number?" So I'm giving him my telephone number. "No, that's not it. Another one. That's not it." I said, I don't know what to do. Somebody set this up for me. So then when he reads back the number, when we finally assess what the real number is, it was my number with two digits reversed. Now, I never would have known this. It was like a 3-2, and they had a 2-3. I would have never been able to figure it out. Now, what's the moral of the story? Was my computer person that I hired learning disabled? I don't know. He may not have been. But I was agitated. I was having stress, very simply because two numbers were reversed. Look at the implications. I may not have gotten my mail. I was ready to hire the guy to come over for $100 an hour to fix my computer because I was desperate, because two numbers were reversed. Now, that's an example, theoretically, of a learning disability called dyslexia. Just think for a moment. If you had this and you were reversing things through your life, you would be susceptible to a lot of internal confusion. And this is a fairly benign example of a learning disability. There are many. Dyslexia probably is the most common example. Lately, there's been a lot of discussion about attention deficit disorder, which is something we'll get into a little more in more detailed fashion as we go on. That can be a pervasive syndrome, too. Reading deficits, auditory processing deficit, organizational deficits, specific learning disabilities with math, with reading. I mean, we all have our own ability to learn. I know, for example, that I am an auditory learner versus a visual learner. It's easier for me to listen to an audio cassette and to learn from that than to read a book. Not that I can't read a book, and I don't think I have genuinely a learning disability, but sometimes I wonder. But when a person has a learning disability, we are talking about a biological, molecular, physiological component of the system that is not working right. As part of the marketing for this seminar, I got a phone call, and a woman said to me, "Wow, you know, you're doing this workshop. I want you to be aware of how learning disabilities are created. There's a real big issue related to anesthesiology." Well, obviously, there is. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you can have stories of during the birth process when anesthesiology kicked in incorrectly. And this woman was saying to me, "You should do something about it." Well, we live in an age of specialization, and this woman had a very good point, but we are doing what we can, which is focusing on the socialization, emotional, psychological sources and treatment facilities available for the learning disabled, even though she had a good point. There is no cure that I know of for a learning disability. There are some things that come close. There's a lot of compensation that can be had. There are many different functioning levels, which is another thing we'll get into when later on in the workshop. But what I want to say now and make clear now is that the person with a learning disability is more susceptible to internal confusion, to perceptual problems. What does this turn into? Mistakes, which is a normal part of life. We've all made them. Failure, rejection. It turns into something else called anxiety. One woman that I spoke to on the phone for a couple of minutes said, "My child is young. She has learning disabilities. She does not yet have anxiety." I don't know. I think this person, anxiety, by the way, is a fact of life. It's okay to have anxiety. It's not okay to let it control you. That's when we have a problem. But if I were 5 years old or 10 years old and I had a learning disability and I had this internal confusion and I was struggling, I would be developing anxiety. It starts somewhere. There are seeds to it. That's a very important thing to understand. An interesting quote in the 1993 Journal of Psychiatry went like this. "The 80s was a decade of anxiety, primarily characterized by obsessive compulsive disorder and panic disorder. The 90s will continue to be a decade of anxiety. What's going to come to the forefront is social anxiety and social phobia." This is a very big thing of what we are addressing today. When we're talking about social anxiety, social phobia, and shyness, another word for shyness, we are talking about performance issues. And it's very amazing. I have, in the work that I've done, from the book that I've written, from the media appearances that I've had, I've been lucky enough to have talked to many people around the country and the world. And one of the amazing things that I have found out is that even though this is, quote, the anxiety disorder of the decade, there are less than a handful of programs around the country to address this problem. The other day on the internet, I had an inquiry from somebody from Brazil who was coming in for treatment. Why? Well, one, he found me on the internet, and two, there's no place in his country for it. But I get phone calls every day from Chicago, California, Texas. Where can we go? Sorry, I can't refer you. I do not know where. Why? Because most of the people who have social anxiety, extreme shyness, and social phobia are controlled by underlying emotions of fear of embarrassment, rejection, humiliation, and shame. And more often than not, they do not come for help. Inherently, it is resistance. And the professional community, the medical and the psychotherapy community as a whole, is very confused about how to handle this, which is one of the reasons that there are so few programs available. One of the things that I have seen in informal research, I'm not a researcher, I'm a clinician, but there has been some components of informal research. Take this figure of about 10,000 people that I have worked with. I have found something absolutely amazing, and that is 50% of the individuals who have come to me since 1978 have had some kind of a learning disability. Because that's a very important component of the social anxiety concept. Whether we're talking about the investment banker who makes $700,000 a year, who has dyslexia, who's coming to me because he has fear of public speaking, which is one of the things that I work with the most, or whether it's the person who has a pervasive developmental disability who has been in special education his or her life, they have many things in common. I don't put them in the same group together because of functioning level, but they share this commonality. So anxiety is a very, very important thing to understand, and we'll attack it again later. Now, what does anxiety do? Anxiety leads to something very important. Major, major concept. We live in a world of addictions. Addictions to cigarettes, to alcohol, to drugs, to food, to sex, to the internet. I'm finding that's a new one. But the addiction that we are addressing here is the addiction to avoidance. Avoidance. Avoidant behavior. Whether we're talking about fear of socializing, fear of dating, fear of dealing with an authority figure, a supervisor, fear of speaking in front of a group, fear avoiding communication, avoiding any kind of social responsibility, we have an addiction. And that, by the way, is one of the ways that you measure the severity of the problem, by how much does the person in question avoid what's threatening, whether the person is 4 or 5 years old, or whether the person is 27 years of age. The average age in my practice, you know, sometimes when I'm doing a radio or TV show about shyness, the average listener thinks we're talking about children. I wish we were. The average age in my practice is in the late 20s. Because what happens is, even though the patterns are usually present in childhood, the tendency is to say, leave them alone, they'll grow out of it. Or the parents don't want to stigmatize the child by saying, you got a problem. So what happens is the anxiety works its way more and more into the personality. I'm not saying that some people don't grow out of it, but you have to be objective. The anxiety works its way more and more into the personality, and you have this avoidance addiction. Now, you cannot be really good at being avoidant unless you are also an expert at being dependent. Dependent. That's why you are all here. That's why if somebody comes to my practice, very typical situation, I get a call from a woman of a 26-year-old. I would like you to see my son. Great. I'd like to see you and your husband first. What do you want to see us for? He's 26 years old. Why are you making the telephone call? Okay, we have to start somewhere. That's subtle. But dependency can be broken into different categories: financial, emotional, and practical. The person who is locked into any addiction to avoidance also has the dynamics of dependency present. So, as a concerned adult or parent, if any of this is making sense to you and you're looking for productivity for your child or the person you're concerned about, you've got to have a game plan. You've got to have your map. Because all too often you take a person 10 years old, 15 years old, 30 years old, and they go to therapy or whatever, and the parents, the people who are dependent on, do not have a game plan or a therapeutic strategy to follow. More often than not, there will not be any productivity. Now, what's happening when there's avoidance? The person certainly is not learning social skills. A lot of times, people will tell me, my child has a problem with social skills. Yes, they do. Of course they do. However, the tendency can be to be simplifying it. You're not going to learn social skills until you are out in the mainstream. So usually, before you can get to the social skills issue, you have to get to the avoidance issues and the anxiety issues. Sure, I can say, someone can come into my office and I can have a blackboard, and I can say, here are the rules for social skills. Look at a person in the eyes, shake their hands. These are some tips on how to have a conversation and a discussion. Here's some basic etiquette. But what do you do when the person says, I don't want this, I don't need this, I don't have a problem, or when the anxiety debilitates the person? Then you've got a problem. You've got a structural problem, and you have to deal with both of these issues concurrently in order to be successful. Which then leads us to self-esteem. Big issue. And a lot of people say, I'm coming to you or I want this particular program because my child has a self-esteem issue. Well, the person who is hiding out in their room alone, and there's a lot of that, by the way, has no self-esteem. The person who is interacting poorly has low self-esteem. And those people who are interacting, see, it all comes down to this social concept, interacting well in life, their self-esteem tends to be higher. And the more that the self-esteem is diminished, the more there is this avoidance, the more we then have potential for some other things. The New York Times had an article once that said, there is more distress associated with loneliness than with smoking cigarettes. And with a lot of the people that I see, there are a lot of stress disorders, panic attacks, migraine headaches, irritable bowel syndrome, asthma. This doesn't happen by magic. This is the result of distress, adaptation to negative things, and it can be physiological as well as psychological and emotional. Usually what happens is when we can take a person on a productive route to change, their self-esteem will increase as they start to interact more productively. I hope I'm making sense so far. Am I making sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. At this point, what I'd like to do is introduce an associate of mine. This is Dr. Eliran Elias, who has... I need a break, and you put yourself on the spot. So... Eliran has been working with me for about 12 years. Eliran is a psychotherapist on my staff. He teaches at NYU. And being a creative type of a person, I always appreciate newness or something creative. Eliran has the first PhD in the world in drama therapy. It's a very fascinating thing, which means that when a person comes to see him, you have an audience there. When a person comes to see him, it doesn't mean he's sitting doing drama. What it means is that he has a very creative, experiential approach to therapy. And what Eliran is going to do right now is to talk a little bit about, and also Eliran is the group leader and executive director of the Friendship Foundation, which is the sponsoring group of today's seminar. So, Eliran?
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to talk a lot because I'm creative, he said. So why talking? I believe that the first thing that everybody is afraid of when they come to the Friendship Connection is when I go around and say, can you tell me please what's your name and what you're doing? That is scary. So I thought, why don't you guys experience a little bit of what your kids maybe experience a little bit? Can any of you just tell us a little bit why you're here? I'd like to have like 10 people maybe. Go ahead. Yeah. Nothing to do with that? Okay, I'll speak much louder. So we'd like to have a few people coming here and saying why you are here. Other than reading, go ahead. Stand up, please.
My son is 13 years old, who has pervasive developmental disorder. He has a lot of difficulty with his social skills, and I was hoping there's something more coming up.
Can you tell us what you're doing so far? Is he in any program? Is he going to social group? Is he in therapy?
He is not in therapy. He's in the public school, a self-contained classroom. And they really don't know how to address the special issues in the school.
Thank you. Yes, please. Just stand up.
I have 7 12-year-olds twins who are both going to deal with socialization skills, who have gone through intense therapy, who have gone through socialization in therapy, has it worked? We need to know what else there is out there for them.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
And I'm here for myself. I wasn't diagnosed learning disabled until 1990, and I'm not saying how old I was. Obviously, I was not a youngster. And I have gone the routes that I do understand to go to, but psychologists in the mainstream have not been able to help, so that's why I'm here.
Thank you. Yes, please.
And I'm here because my son is 15 and a half years old, and he has a lot of some learning disabilities and ADD, which I had picked up very early on rather than the school because I do have a background in LD. He has finally opened up to therapy after many years of trying back and forth different doctors. But now he's at the point where he kind of went back five steps to maybe make some progress, and he wants friends. He's totally isolated. He's found some kind of help through music. I've been doing all kinds of research, trying to meet all kinds of different people. We've got a music therapist, and he's very much into, he's very creative and into guitar and music, and that kind of has helped him through. But he wants friends desperately, and I've tried different groups. I've tried the Y, that wasn't an appropriate program, and I'm just looking for ways to help him.
Well, what's stopping him from having friends?
What's stopping him?
Yes.
He, socially, he's just not ready. He's socially immature. He doesn't have the skills, social skills, within his peer group. He's young for his grade. He gets along differently with adults and children, but with people in his grade, first of all, he's been already stigmatized and he has no self-esteem, and there's been so much improvement as the years went on, but you know, people know that he's different and he feels that he's different, even though he looks physically very together and very with it. He feels very alone and very different.
Thank you. A few more. Yes, please.
Yes, I have an 8-year-old son, and he has ADD, and he probably has other learning disabilities that we don't know about, and he's been in special ed preschool since 3 years old, and when he was in the preschool, he was doing very well. Once he got into the school system, he started regressing. So he does well, he regresses, and we're here because my husband and I were trying to find someone who can help us. We've already been to different psychiatrists. We tried Ritalin, Dexedrine, and they're not working. Mm-hmm. We need help.
Okay, last one over there. Thank you.
Hi. I'm on respite right now. I have worked in the learning disability developmentally disabled field, and I feel a magnet to keep coming back. And when I hear these families, these are the people that I'd like to work with. Because I do see the socialization skills of the individuals that I've worked with that struggle. In fact, just before I came here, I had coffee with two of them this morning. And it really breaks my heart. There are not innovative programs. And I'm really happy to hear there's something out here on Long Island.
Okay, thank you. So we heard, I believe, that many of you guys who did not say anything probably related to what other people said. I will be taking their parts a little bit because I'm working with them a lot. And I see them in my office, a therapist. I see them when they come to the Friendship Connection. I eat with them. I go to movies with them. I go on trips with them. I talk to them about their girlfriends. And what I did find, really I did, that this world is just too much for them. There's a lot here. It's a very competitive world. It's a time urgency kind of a world, isn't it? And they've been thrown into this world. The noise is too loud. The light is too bright. The past is too fast, and they just don't know what to do. We are, in part, can give them a little bit of a map. I like this map stuff. A map. Because without map, nobody can do anything. And sometimes we ourselves need to change our strategy, the maps, whatever. But we need to have some maps. So I will be talking a lot about the social part of the LD person. I will stop here, and you will continue. Then I'll take it over.
Yes.
Structure is this created by lab and sources and run by adults. not a, it doesn't really, there are many cases, of course, of the current social skills are working, but it's developed because things are done for them basically, and continues that tendency.
I did not see the article, but continuing dependency is, you know, you must have read my mind because I want to tell this story now, which is perfect for that. Talking about confusion of parents, this woman is talking to me about her son who's 38 years old, works for the family business, has pervasive developmental disabilities, 6 feet tall, good looking guy, is nearing in one ear, drives, makes $600 a week. Does not go to work, gets paid anyway, said, I went to, had a full battery of tests at one of the local universities, which is, you know, one of the prestigious ones, and the mother is saying, you know, he's just not capable. He's just not capable of doing A, B, or C. He ran up a credit card problem, which is something I see a lot with learning disabled adults because it's a compensation of power, you know, plastic power. You do whatever you want. So the parents took away the credit card. And here is this person who the mother is saying he just can't do anything. Well, he was smart enough to be able to call up the credit card companies on his own and get new credit cards after they had been taken away. He was smart enough to go to his internist and negotiate getting on disability by himself. Okay, so we're talking about a perpetuation of dependence, which you started to share about, which is so important about what we're talking. Now, at this point, we have something special. I would like to introduce you to someone. His name is David. He has been a patient of mine, and now I see him for some maintenance work once a month. He has a very interesting story to tell. And keeping in mind that fear of speaking in front of groups is the number one phobia in this country, let's give him a little round of applause as he comes up. Where do you want to sit or stand?
Doesn't matter.
You, wherever you're
comfortable. I'll stand. Well, as Jonathan has said, I've been a patient of his for a few years, and this never gets any easier, public speaking, but I'm actually doing it, so you'll have to bear with me if I stumble over a few words. I was born with a learning disability, a fine motor learning disability, and I also have dyslexia.
The microphone is working.
Okay. So I was born with a fine motor coordination disability and a dyslexia. And I wasn't really aware of what the disability meant to me until I was about in the sixth grade. I went to yeshiva, which is private school. And the reason why I went there is it was important to my parents, it was important to me. But I really didn't get any help in terms of my learning disabilities, and I really didn't understand that I had learning disabilities then. I had teachers working with me, explaining to me, you know, this is how you write cursive or something like that. I remember the thing that will stick out with me until the day I die is my first grade Hebrew teacher yelling at me for the way that my handwriting was. And that's one of the ways that my disability became, you know, showed itself in school. I went through elementary school with really no problems socially. Then I went to junior high school, again to yeshiva, and I had a little bit more problems there because it was a lot bigger, and I kind of got lost in the equation. Again, no really help for my learning disabilities at all. Struggling, you know, see work. Had my parents, you know, nudging me. Why don't you do your homework instead of watching TV or playing ball? And I got very upset. I wouldn't say I was depressed yet. I then transferred to public school where I did very well. I did about B plus work. And I think it was there that I first discovered that I have you know, some people called it being really shy. I didn't really talk to anyone. I felt very out of place. You know, it was not my thing. I had some friends in my other school, and I left them behind, and just felt very lonely and very isolated. I stayed in my room a lot of times. You know, the TV was my best friend. The TV and computer games was one of my two best friends. And I then transferred back to Yeshiva, and I graduated. And then my life got very interesting after that. About 10 years ago, I went to the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. And the reason why I went there was because my parents really thought that it would be good for me to get away from home because I was very dependent on them. I grew up in a very loving, nurturing family. You know, my parents gave me all the love and support for myself and my three brothers. And it was fantastic to grow up in, probably too much. Sorry, Mom. So I was sent away to school, and I actually, the first couple of days, I actually did go to classes, and I felt very uncomfortable. I felt like people were staring at me. No one was, you know, everyone had their eyes on me. It doesn't matter what I was doing. And then, and this is probably because I had very low self-esteem because I really didn't succeed in school at all. Because of the learning disability, I didn't get the proper help that I needed. The fourth day of school, I decided I'm not going to classes anymore. There's a TV in my dorm room. You know, there are a lot of good talk shows on. I'm going to sit in my room and watch TV and eat and just be miserable. And, you know, make up stories to my professors, you know, tell my parents that everything's going okay. Yes, I'm going to classes. Yes, I failed the test, but I'll study harder. I turned in this paper. Can you help me with this? And that lasted a bunch, 9 weeks. And it was Halloween when my parents came up and picked me and said, you know, basically, you failed out of school. I was then referred to another therapist that I had seen when I was younger, and I lied to her about what I was doing. I did an odd job in between, and I then went to Nassau Community College, and I had another very interesting experience there. We were talking about credit cards and being inventive, and my father actually put $500 in my ATM. I had an ATM that I could use, and I used it very well. I went back and forth to Manhattan. I went to Roosevelt Field. I saw just about every movie that was out in 1988. You know, went to Manhattan, played in the game room at Penn Station. I had a great time. You know, went to, you know, pizza, then went for hamburgers, you know. I was having the best time of my life then. And of course, my parents found out that I wasn't going to classes there either. It's there where I met Jonathan. And my first image of Jonathan was that I was, to be honest with you, I was scared of him. I didn't go willingly. I believe my father made the phone call to him, and I remember vividly when we went, and he was a very intimidating person, and I really didn't know exactly what was wrong with me. Why was I afraid of people? I was afraid of myself. I really liked staying in my room, not really going out at all, and just, you know, being to myself, and I really thought everyone was looking at me. No socializing at all. You know, I went to Human Resources in Albertson, and that was probably the low point of my life, because I was told by a counselor there that you have a learning disability and you're never going to graduate college, so you just try and find something else to do. And I don't know if this woman probably did some good because she inspired me. And with going to therapy, I then went to Suffolk Community College, where my mother teaches, and I took a class, two classes. I got two A's, and I got a little confidence, and I still was not really socializing. My mother was a professor there, and I stayed most of the time in her office, you know, being friendly with her friends because they were older, and they weren't as threatening as the younger people. And, you know, I went there, I graduated, and I fell in love with my first girlfriend, and I met her through a personal ed. And that relationship lasted about 8 months, and it was a really good experience for me. I was seeing Jonathan at the time. I was involved in group therapy. I was gaining confidence in myself. And then when that relationship fell apart, I had said to myself, and your children may say the same things to themselves, that, well, all I need is a relationship, or all I need is a job, or all I need is this or that. I need this one thing to be the, complete the equation of my life. Well, that wasn't exactly right. After that relationship failed, I kind of, went back to my old behavior. I still went to classes, but I was going to Adelphi University at the time, and I transferred. And I, still cut a lot of classes, still, avoided everyone. My social skills were not great. They were a little bit better. I started taking some communications courses and doing some public speaking, and I felt a little bit better about myself because I was going to school. I was making something of myself. And I really, they had the learning disability help at the time, but I said, I didn't get it in high school. Why am I going to get it in college? I'm going to do it on my own. And my parents were very supportive. Again, maybe even too supportive. My father and my mother, to a lesser role, did a lot of my work in college for me. My father, was in the banking world, and he had a lot of downtime in his job, and I took some history courses. My father loves history, so he got some very good grades for me. I'm very happy to say. But he did a lot of my work in college, and my mother did the typing for my papers. So I had basically had it easy. I just showed up to the classes when I felt like it, and piece of cake. My father doing the papers, my mother typing the papers. All I had to do was go to class when I felt like it. My social skills, started to get a little bit better again. I started to go to parties, but feeling very uncomfortable. Standing kind of like in the background. Forcing myself to go because, that's what Jonathan and I had discussed, and he didn't say, I'm going to, monitor you and make sure that you go, but it was up to me. It was my choice to go, and I went on some singles weekends, and basically, just being very quiet, staying in the back, but, all the while, I guess, gaining a little bit more confidence and a little bit more confidence. I graduated Adelphi University in 1993 with a BS in elementary education, and I substitute taught for 2 years, and it was a very frustrating thing. It was a very anxiety-ridden thing because you were going into different schools all the time, and this is something that I explored with Jonathan, how I didn't have any control of the classes, and it was just, I had a major anxiety. My hands would sweat, my underarms would sweat, and it was just very nerve-wracking, but somehow I managed to do it. Yeah, there was still a little avoidance with me. I mean, that's one of the big things that has plagued me since I've discovered my problems, is that I've avoided things. And now that I'm here today, obviously, I've, cut down on that significantly, I would hope. So I graduated. Like I said, I graduated. I taught in the school system, very nerve-wracking situation. You're going into the South Bronx and just different situations. Teachers that are there every day don't really relate to a substitute teacher that well. And, I had anxiety, but I faced my anxiety. I said, well, what would I be doing if I wasn't doing this? I'd be sitting home. I'd be playing Sega Genesis. I'd be watching TV. I'd be eating Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. I'd be doing this. I'd be doing that. I finally moved out of my parents' home. I moved into the city with my brother because I thought it'd be good to cut the strings, because my parents all along were very, very supportive, but I was financially dependent, emotionally dependent, and any other way you could think of, I was dependent on my parents and on my family. I moved into the city, and it was just, I thought it would be very good for me. It turned out not to be so good for me. I was subbing, and I stayed in my apartment the whole time watching.